Well, thank you very much to the previous two speakers. Thank you to Nick, thank you to Professor Chi, and thank you to the Foundation for inviting me to be the third speaker today. I thought I was going to have to be a bit controversial and create a bit of debate, but I don't think I do now, so that's good. I can act as a sort of moderate voice between the two, perhaps. For those who don't meet, I have two roles. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Defence Fund in Europe. That's a US-based charity, been around since the 60s, and 3 years ago put a permanent office into Europe and appointed me as their Executive Director to bring their voice to bear here. So I think why I've been invited is partly because I've got that connection to the US, so I'm here to talk a little bit about the US in that context and how perhaps we can look to the US for some positive news amongst all the gloom, but I'll come on to that. I've also had a role in Parliament and before that worked in the NGO sector and was very fortunate enough to be involved in the writing and the campaigning for the Climate Change Act, which the UK passed in 2008, and has survived for 10 years, I'm glad to see. So I'm here to answer the exam question of will the Paris agreement be delivered? And I thought I'd sort of cover off perhaps one way of looking at that question, which is, will it survive? Will the multilateral effort that was agreed in 2015 make it through? What are some pretty turbulent political times? It's been described as the age of bewilderment in politics at the moment. Nobody really knows what's going on. And it's not just in Westminster. So, and I think my conclusion on that, having thought about it, is that it will. And obviously, Trump cast it into doubt by deciding that he was going to pull out of the Paris Agreement. But I think there was a clever aide in the White House who was behind the announcement, because if you notice the timing, he made that announcement one day after the deadline at which he could have made it and pulled out before the next election in the US. So that announcement in the Rose Garden in the White House was a day after the day when he could have made that announcement and would have had a material impact in his presidency. Instead, he made it the day after, which meant that he actually can't pull out of the Paris Agreement until after the next presidential election. So that's, I think, down to some clever planning, some smart people in the White House. But it tells you that the symbol he sent of pulling out is damaging, but he can't actually withdraw the US until we have another chance, perhaps, at re-establishing some sensible voices into the White House. But, I mean, it's no doubt that it's had a negative effect. And if for no other reason, then it gives legitimacy to a whole cadre of people who have some quite extreme views. And, if the President of the United States is claiming that climate change is a hoax, and that it's going to be damaging to, there's no need to take it seriously, then that does give license to a whole suite of people who perhaps otherwise would have not been feeling so confident about speaking out. So for that reason, it is important. But and here I think we've got some evidence that it has had a strangely galvanising effect on a huge number of people. Had Trump stayed in, imagine if Trump had stayed in and said, you know what, Paris is so useless, I'm going to stay in it because it doesn't do anything. The act of him pulling out kind of reinforced in many people's minds that, well, this must be something worth having. Perhaps you should all ratify really quickly in record time and get every single other country in the world to do so. And that's exactly what happened, including countries who had said, from the start they weren't interested in Nicaragua. These people came in and signed as a symbol of unity that one country's decisions wasn't going to jeopardise the rest of the world's efforts to try and take this issue seriously. And Paris, by and large, I do agree with Professor Chi's comments that the UN tends to get into the weeds a little bit and take itself a little bit too seriously. But what it symbolises is that narrative and that sentiment that we are finally, as a world, trying to take this seriously. And sentiment matters. It matters because we are, as a species, interested in stories and narratives, and that's a strong narrative that we have finally, in 2015, made a stand and come together. And it will have an effect of changing people's decisions when it comes to marginal decisions. So if you're a company weighing up investment decisions or R&D, future plans for R&D, the fact that, by and large, you're not an expert in climate change, but you remembered that, a couple of years ago, it seemed as if the world started to take this seriously. It creates that sense that to be on the right side of history, you should be moving into a more positive, sustainable business model. I've seen that firsthand, actually, when I was working at a power company, and the Climate Change Act had just been passed, and they were considering a big capital investment into new power generation, and it was marginal. The costs of doing it or not doing it were not clear, but they I was there as they presented to the board, and they said, but, you know, the Climate Change Act's just been passed, so we, on balance, we think we should do this. So, you know, even hard-nosed business people, when you've got a narrative that's compelling and it's widely understood, it does have these tipping point and nudge effects, which is important. So, going back to the question of will it survive, I think, you know, Bolsonaro, as Nick alluded to, not great news for the climate. But again, he has decided not to pull out. His environment minister has said that they will stay in, and that they will obviously be difficult. Brazil are very hard-nosed negotiators, and they'll know what they need and want to get out of it. But the fact, again, that they've not pulled out is good. There are other countries we can worry about who are less important, perhaps Australia. Always been difficult. But again, I think Australia's politics is changing. If you're suffering from the worst heat wave in living history and you've got an election bearing down on you, I think the environment will be on the agenda in that election in a way that it perhaps hasn't been previously. So I think even Australia, who has been sort of in the troublesome gang, we might see some shifts there. So I think, by and large, Paris, the consensus around Paris will remain, and it will continue through its processes. Now, the second part of the exam question, though, is that process in itself sufficient? Is it going to deliver on its goals? And there, I think, the picture is slightly more gloomy, and perhaps not as gloomy as Professor Chee's perspective, but there are many challenges with that approach. The good things, let's start with the good things. I mean, firstly, as I say, it's a centre symbolism that we are coming together to try and tackle this. And it's also written a fairly clear equation for us to solve, which is, they've written up the temperature goals, but if you read the text, it says anthropogenic sources of greenhouse gases must be balanced by anthropogenic sinks to reach zero sometime before 2100. So that's the first acknowledgement that this is a controlling sources and enhancing sinks equation. And I think that subtly changes the way the UN views this, because for too long we've viewed this as, I think, rather ideologically, and apologies, Nick, because it perhaps conflicts with some of your slides, that this is all just about renewables. It's all about 100% renewables and energy efficiency, and that's going to be the path to a solution. In my experience, that is fantastic goal to aim for, but is utterly, utterly impractical and insufficient in the timescales we're talking about. You have to throw as many technologies as you can sustainably do at this problem if we're going to hit those amazingly steep curves. So ruling out all sorts of approaches at this stage is absolutely crazy. So as much as I love the ambition of 100% renewables and the sunrise movement and all this great enthusiasm around it, that is going to be important for pulling the politics into a more positive state, but we should not be seduced into thinking this is just a question, putting up a load of solar panels and a few wind turbines, and hey presto, the world will be a cleaner place in time. There is a whole suite of technologies we must look at, and the UN in particular must embrace that plurality of solutions, and I think that Paris equation is the first written example that they are accepting the scale of the challenge and that it's both a sources and a sinks issue. So I think that was a very useful thing to have emerged in the final hours of the Paris negotiation. I think the question of is it sufficient? I mean, the bottom-up approach was always going to be a tricky one, wasn't it? I mean, it's, you know, you let a country decide what it's going to do, and they will come forward with a business-as-usual minus a little bit in order to feel comfortable. The EU is a classic case in that. Our 40% reduction by 2030 sounds good, but to be honest, we're going to be well over 30% reduction by the end of this decade, and we'll have another decade to just deliver 1% per annum reduction. That is nowhere near the level of reduction we need to see from Europe as a leading industrialised nation going into this challenge. So we've all lowballed, everybody's lowballed their offer, and as a result, you know, we're heading towards a 3-degree deal, not a 1.5-degree deal. But, you know, there are some, I think the negotiators knew this, they've built in some important features, the Talanoa dialogue about trying to get countries together to agree on a process for increasing that ambition, the 5-yearly review process, which will already kick in 2020, that's just around the corner, where you could see countries coming forward with an increased ambition to close that gap. And I think there's details hidden amongst all of the legalese around allowing countries to collaborate and to open up shared ambition. Trading of ambition is still within possibility of this. So you could see bilateral and multilateral clubs of countries coming together to go further with mutually beneficial investment programs. So bits of Paris do offer some hope, I think. And there is always a but, I think, it is clear that, and I think it's not me that said this, but I remember someone saying, the problem with Paris is it's the wrong people talking about the wrong issues in the wrong place. And there is an element of that, in that you gather together the world's environment ministers, and you, by and large, you're going to get a certain type of dialogue and a certain sort of outcome. If you forget to include the world's treasury ministers, finance ministers, their energy ministers, and their transport ministers, then your progress will not be necessarily fast, because you'll sign up to something internationally, come back domestically, and hit up against a domestic brick wall where the economics just isn't in your favour. You can't push through the kind of transport policies that you need. You can't get that energy investment programme you need to get to the kinds of targets we need. So where does that leave us? Well, I wanted to just reflect on two, sort of, again, glimmers of hope. I've become, I have to say, somewhat obsessed with the sectors that are outside of Paris, because there are two global sectors that are not covered by the Paris Agreement, and that's the aviation and shipping sectors. Now, between them, although they count for maybe 4 or 5% of global emissions, and that's, you know, not insignificant, it's about the size of, in each individually, are about the size of Germany's annual emissions. But the interesting thing about them is that they live in a world of which they are governed by a very old-fashioned form of UN governance, created in the 1950s, when really the pooling of sovereignty happened because of just commerce, because we needed to have common rules to enable money to flow and money to be made. So those two kind of offshoots, old parts of the UN, and certainly the shipping is the oldest, has the capacity to write global rules that apply to everyone. The concept of common but differentiated responsibilities, though it pops up in the debate, doesn't really apply. They want a level playing field, because actually in shipping, you could be flagged somewhere, have your ship there, trade it between two different ports. You don't really tie yourself to an individual country, and you certainly don't think in the world in terms of developed and developing. It's a much more realistic view, actually, of today's world, which is it's an interconnected global world, and very footloose, that industry in particular. So they have, for the longest time, been criticised for not taking environmental issues seriously. And I think that's a fair criticism. But more recently, they have started to take action. They've signed up 10 years ago to cleaning sulphur out of their fuels, and that's just starting now to kick in. And last year, they agreed to a climate change reduction target of a 50% cut, so halving their emissions from 2008 baseline by mid-century. And that's a target that they have signed up to, which they now are busily writing policies to get to that target. Now, the reason I think this is interesting is because in that context, you've got a lot of engineers, a lot of technical people, a lot of finance people, a lot of very practical people thinking through, okay, what would it take for me to invest in a vessel that's going to be zero emissions by 2030? And the kinds of dialogues I see happening there, it's not universal, let's be honest, there are still people who, you know, very much want to stay with the status quo. But it's the sort of technical conversation about practical policies that are enacted at a global level that kind of gives me hope. And so that, as an organisation, we're putting quite a lot of effort into that process. 2019 is a crucial year. This is when policies are coming forward to be discussed by member states and to be signed into law. And I'd like to hope that, because shipping is very practical, and they have once been zero emissions, let's remember, they didn't use fossil fuels a long time ago. They have the capacity to move to either hydrogen, electrified ships for short haul, and ammonia as a potential hydrogen carrier, to be zero carbon. They just need to find the policy and the will to make that policy happen. So that's what we're working on. So I give you that as a little example of multilateralism in a world where, you know, you read the headlines, multilateralism is well out of favour at the moment, but here this little pocket of global industry is moving ahead. Now, aviation is the other example. I'm not going to dwell on that as much, but that, again, despite its shaky start, has created a common metric and a common way of thinking about emissions that applies to nearly everyone. It's a bit more voluntary, it's more focused on offsetting and carbon markets than than technological investments. But again, it provides a template, an example of a global sector coming forward and trying to write rules that will drive investment. And that's the thing, is to driving investment. I think, is that one minute?
Yeah.
One minute. Fine. Okay. But I'll quickly. So my question is, if we've got those examples and we know that the conversations in the UN aren't quite the right conversations, how do we start having conversations that move towards a more multilateral groups of the willing to come together to talk about steel? Well, you know, steel is a global sector. There are not that many players. There are not that many countries. How could we think about driving some common rules that would take out some of the politics of, if this country applies a carbon levy to its steel industry, it's going to be shot down by industry because it's not applied in other countries. So, you know, are there ways in which we can start to have sectoral level discussions at a global scale with the industry to see whether they would benefit, and I'm certain they would, from a common rule book that they could all then internalise and go forward without all this politicking. My last, just if I've got 1 minute, just a half a minute to finish, just to, another note of optimism, is technology. And we as an organisation have adopted a phrase which is the fourth wave of environmentalism, which really means that we are now, as citizens, as people, as NGOs, able, because of the reducing costs of technology, to do extraordinary things. EDF, Environmental Defence Fund, is launching its own satellite. I don't want to tell you exactly how much it costs, it's quite eye-watering, but we as an NGO, a modestly sized NGO, have found the funds to launch our own satellite, and we're going to be monitoring methane emissions at a global level. Now, that was absolutely not possible 10 years ago. It's only possible now because technology costs are coming down. And just by actually Fred Krupp standing on a stage and saying we were going to launch a satellite, suddenly we're finding the oil and gas industry much more receptive to our calls, because they know that we'll have this thing in the sky before too long and they won't be able to hide. So I'll leave that with you, that technology costs don't just matter in terms of CO2. They matter because they enable us all to become more active citizens and for us to have, I think, the data and the knowledge we need to tackle this problem. So thank you.